And we're back with What's Ailing America, where our answer today is the Holocaust hoax with my special guest, Deanna Spingola. And Deanna, a follow-up to this whole Dr. Mengele thing, I have a book called Project Paperclip, you know, where they claim that all the mad scientists were brought over to the States and other places from Nazi Germany. What's the story with that? Is that whole thing a hoax as well?
No, it isn't. Actually, what the all war is economic, and when they when the Allies went into Germany, they basically plundered the country. They plundered it of the art treasures. They also took a lot of the patents that that the Germans had developed, and they also took the best scientists. And it was either, you know, go to Russia, go to the Soviet, work there, or come to America. They didn't have a choice. And so Project Paperclip was indeed a project wherein they took the best talent out of Germany and brought them over here. They didn't have a choice.
It's really amazing that Germany was even able to rebuild herself, considering the fact that they were forced to pay reparations on top of rebuilding the company, the country. I mean, it's amazing that they were even able to pull that off.
Well, that's why they had to develop this Holocaust hoax in order to extract even greater reparations on a personal level from at least, it was over 3 million Jews actually applied for reparations payments from the German government, from the West German government.
Claiming that they had been in the camps? Was that their excuse for
yes,
why they wanted?
Yes. Claiming so that they were.
So not only were 6 million allegedly killed, but 3 million were allegedly in the camps as well. I mean, that's a lot of Jewish people to be in Germany.
Exactly. And a lot of them had actually left Germany by 1939. And there were not 6 million Jews under the jurisdiction of Germany, even in the countries that they occupied. There were probably around 2 million total in Europe. Okay. And there was one situation, particularly in Poland, where they said, "Oh, there was 300,000 Jews here, and you know, when the Germans came in, they just slaughtered them." But actually, what happened in Warsaw, where these 300,000 Jews were, is that you know, none of them could be accounted for after the German invasion of September 1939. But what happened is that these missing Jews actually went to Russia, and a lot of them got sent to the Gulag and were never heard of again. And this came out in 1994 after the official records were opened in the Soviet around 1991, when the Soviet gave up communism, allegedly.
Okay, if you could give us the big picture of Hitler, you know, one of the things you hear out there is that he was an illegitimate son of a Rothschild, implying that he was actually, you know, Jewish blood himself. What was his real agenda? I mean, did he have a thing about the Jews? Was he putting them in camps because of their inability to, like you said, follow the rules of the countries in which they were living? Or what's the real story on Hitler?
Okay, he was not Jewish. There have been a couple of books that have proven his ethnicity. The people who are saying that he was the son of a Rothschild do this in order to support the theory that he went into Germany, that perhaps he was trained by the at Tavistock in Great Britain, and that he actually was sent to destroy the country, when in fact it was the Allies that bombed the heck out of the country. And one of the best places to read about what he felt is to read Mein Kampf. Now, you can't get it in certain countries. In fact, I had a listener in Amsterdam who went into her local bookstore and asked the assistant manager for a copy of Mein Kampf. And he said, oh, it's against the law. We can't sell that book. And she said, do you know why? And he said, well, no, I don't. And she said, wouldn't it be a wonderful idea if people all over the world started asking for that book? And, you know, as I said before, the truth does not fear investigation. And if they are, you know, not allowing his words to be available so that people can see for themselves what he felt and what he thought and some of his history, then, you know, I think you'd have a different view of him. Now, the first that we often are told that the very first shot of the Second World War occurred on September 1st, 1939, against Poland. And I don't want to talk about the Gliwice incident, but the very first shot, actually, of the Second World War, although it wasn't with a gun, was in the spring of 1933, 2 months after Hitler became chancellor. It was fired, not literally, but it was when world Jewry, represented in New York by the Congress, the American Jewish Congress, when they actually boycotted Germany and everything that she produced. And that was in the spring of 1933, 2 months after Hitler became chancellor. And this was a very great economic disaster. And so they responded. They responded to that. It would be like, for instance, if, you know, if a bunch of people came into our country, and we do have lots of bunches of people that come into our country, but what if one of the foreign entities in our country all of a sudden decided that worldwide that they were going to boycott everything American and they were living in this country? What would you expect the American government to do? You can compare this to the American government incarcerating all of the Japanese and all of the Germans who were in this country when World War II broke out. They went in, they confiscated the Japanese property, and never to give it back, by the way, confiscated Japanese property, put them on trains, put them in camps in Utah, Nevada, and elsewhere, and that is exactly what Germany did. The Jews during right after World War I, many of the Jews were newly arrived in Germany. They came in to take advantage of the deflated currency in Germany, because the people who were in charge of the Weimar Republic, which many people call them the November criminals, because they basically gave away the country. They accepted the Versailles Treaty. And basically, they destroyed the currency in the country. And you had to have a wheelbarrow full of cash to buy a loaf of bread. And so a bunch of property in Germany became available at pennies on the dollar. And so Jews from the East came in and, you know, gobbled up all of this property. They also had a great deal of influence in the cinema, in the media, in banking, in education, in the medical industry, and this was during that period where the culture, basically, it was decreasing, it was perverse, kind of like what we have coming out of Hollywood now. You know, it was the cabaret scene, and it was during this period of time that the culture really went down, and so.
They destroyed morality.
They absolutely did.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Hitler came in, he wanted to raise the morality standards. And when international Jewry, and they're very, very united, very cohesive group, they act as one group. And when they declared war on Germany, he responded by incarcerating those who were sure to be a problem. And there was a lot of problem right after World War I, because a lot of socialists came into the country. They tried to set up Soviet regions in Bavaria and other places. And, you know, they were infiltrators, just as we had infiltrators in Roosevelt's government here in this country during the 30s. And so it was a terrible situation. So, of course, you are going to incarcerate those people who have sworn that the government is the enemy and that they were going to do you harm.
Right. And basically those who take an oath not to honor their oaths in every area of life that there is, it's just so obvious once you realize the big picture of what's going on. Okay, what about the Reichstag?
The Reichstag fire?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, tell us about that.
There was absolutely no reason for the party to set fire to the Reichstag. Hitler was already in power. He didn't seize power because he already had power. And it was actually a disadvantage for that fire.
So that was another false flag operation, basically.
Well, it was a fire, but the communists, they blamed the communists, and I believe that the communists did indeed set the fire because that's what they were doing over there. Causing a lot of chaos.
All right, there's the music again. We're going to go to another break. We'll be back. This is a short break. Stay tuned, folks. You're learning a lot today. And we're back with What's Ailing America, where our answer today has been the Holocaust hoax with my special guest, Deanna Spingola. And I just have to say, Deanna, this is one area that I just haven't had time to really study. I'm so grateful to you for enlightening my listeners with this information, because your years of research is just mind-boggling in terms of everything that you've discovered. And of course, it's very important for us to be aware of this truth, because of course you're talking about the Jews infiltrating. Look what's happening now. We have AIPAC. As a matter of fact, I've played on my show before Joe Biden on May 9th of 2009, appearing before the AIPAC committee. It was on C-SPAN, where he actually announced that he's a Zionist. And of course, we have the Zionist News Network telling us how Obama's holding a Passover Seder. We have Cynthia McKinney being pushed out of Congress because she refused to sign an Alliance to Israel document. I mean, it's so obvious. We have a Zionist-occupied government, and that's why we're going to hell on a handbasket, clearly.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, getting back to that fire, Hitler was part of a coalition government of National Socialists and Nationalists, and on January 30th, 1933, President Paul von Hindenburg made Hitler the chancellor. It was not a power seizure. Papen was the vice chancellor. And out of a cabinet of 11, there were three National Socialists. And the whole idea of making Hitler the chancellor was the restoration of the Republican constitutional system that the government established in 1919 at Weimar. Now, the National Socialists were adamantly anti-communist and claimed that the communists were trying to do in Germany what they had done in Russia, which began with an armed uprising. So on February 23rd, 1933, Göring ordered the police to raid communist headquarters to collect evidence of this scheme. The police did not find anything. 4 days later, on February 27th, 1933, a fire started in the debating chamber of the Reichstag, and soon the whole building was in flames. And, you know, it was not a power grab. And what they did was blame Hitler for the fire just to make him look bad.
Kind of like 9/11, how the evidence that the Pentagon had lost, how many billions of dollars, you know, you lose?
Yeah, 2.3 trillion. Yeah.
Whatever. You're right. It's kind of convenient how all that evidence just kind of disappeared. Yeah, they're obviously they're using the same master template for all the things that they're doing. Okay, I didn't want to forget to ask you, the Canadian engineer that you mentioned, I forget his name. How was his investigation, you know, handled, or how did they to try to blow him off when he found that these gas chambers couldn't possibly have been gassing all these people.
Okay, Fred Leuchter was actually American, and he was the chief engineer for all the gas chambers used in every single prison in the U.S. And his company produced them. He created them, designed them, and his company produced them. And what he did in Canada was act as a witness for the Ernst Zundel trial back in 1988. And Ernst Zundel actually produced a pamphlet or, you know, a small booklet called Did 6 Million Really Die? And he was a publisher, he was an artist, he was a graphic artist, and after it wasn't his pamphlet. It was written by Richard Harwood in England. He reproduced it. He sent it to a lot of very, very influential people in Canada. Ernst had immigrated from Germany to Canada at the age of 19, had been there for years, just years and years and years. I believe he's like 75 currently. And anyway, the Jewish people up there in Canada took exception to his producing this pamphlet and took him to court for producing false history. And so he used some of his own money. He paid Fred Leuchter's expenses to go to Poland, to go to Auschwitz, to take a photographer with him, to take a secretary with him who happened to be his wife. And they did all of these scientific tests in the chambers where they did the delousing of the clothes. He looked at what was supposed to have been used as the gas chamber, and I believe he did this like in 1987, and he testified that there's absolutely no possibility that the Germans could have done this, could have killed 6 million people, could have killed even one person in a gas chamber. You know, there were flyovers. The Allies did surveillance flyovers. There was never any indication of any forensic evidence that would say that there were millions of people buried, you know, in mass graves. When people die from poison gas, they become very red. They become pink because of the cyanide. There was never any evidence. The bodies were never pink. You know, we saw the bodies. In fact, some of those bodies that we saw in photos were actually from the Dresden bombing, where they would pile up a bunch of bodies. And, you know, it's easy to take a picture and say, oh, yes, this is from the so-called death camp. And so what happened to Fred Leuchter? Well, the Jews destroyed his business. It shows you how unified they are. Here he lived in the United States, and the people in Canada actually had enough influence with the Jews here in this country to destroy his business. He could no longer, and of course, obviously, they have influence with the government because the penitentiaries, the institutions that he designed gas chambers for are government institutions. And all of a sudden, he wasn't getting any contracts. He wasn't getting any work. They destroyed him economically and in every way they possibly could. And what happened with Ernst Zundel is that he was able to come to this country where you have a little bit more freedom to talk about such things. He married a lady and moved to Tennessee, came to this country, and within a year, the United States government was deporting him, and he had to go back to Germany. He spent about 5 years in jail. He is now out, but he cannot come back to this country because obviously he's not going to give up talking about his situation, talking about the fact that the Holocaust is a hoax.
Exactly. And I'm sure that they found some way, because I've experienced enough of the courts to know how it works, that even with his testimony about the fact that these gas chambers couldn't have possibly been killing people, they found a way to exclude it from the record or whatever they decided to do, because that's how they work. But, you know, I'm just picturing Deanna. Just imagine, and I don't want to forget to ask you, your new book, The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power, when do you expect that to be ready to be published? And just picture, you know, history classes all over this country using that book instead of the crap they've got now.
Well, that's not ever going to be a possibility. It's never going to be on the New York Times bestseller list, because books that are on the New York Times bestseller list don't get there because they happen to sell, so many thousands of copies. They get there because the Jew-controlled New York Times wants to promote certain theories and certain versions of history. Book is at the publishers now. I'm self-publishing. And right now it is going through the editing process. And hopefully it'll be out in 3 weeks, hopefully.
Excellent. Well, I'll definitely be letting the listeners know, and I'm looking forward to getting a copy myself, because in my opinion, this is the most important conspiracy reality that people have to wake up to. As a matter of fact, I wanted to also ask you about the protocols of the meetings of the Learned Elders of Zion. There are so many Jewish people who can't face reality. When you read this book, everything they talk about is actually happening. And I just want to quickly read my very favorite snippet from this book. And it's the last sentence of the 10th protocol. And this is what it says. It is indispensable to trouble in all countries the people's relations with their governments so as to utterly exhaust humanity with dissension, hatred, struggle, envy, torture, starvation, by the inoculation of diseases, which is in capital letters, by want, so that the goy see no other issue than to take refuge in our complete sovereignty in money and in all else. And when I found that, I was like, whoa. So this is just further proof that they know exactly what they're doing. And to put inoculation of diseases in capital letters, I mean, you can imagine, you know, how my eyes flied open when I saw that. And there's so many people, like I said, they're saying, oh, this is a fiction and all the other crap they come up with. How is it that everything in that book is actually happening right now, if it's fiction?
Sure. And of course, they've said things in their Zionist congresses. In 1903, Max Nordau actually gave the, let me just give you the quote here. Max Nordau, in August 1903, he was a Hungarian doctor and author, and in his address to the 6th Zionist Congress in Basel, revealed the Basel program for even greater, in order to demonstrate and to talk about the coming world wars. World wars in 1903. And he said, and I quote, "Let me tell you the following words as if I were showing you the rungs of a ladder leading upward and upward. Number one, Theodore Herzl would have the Zionist Congress, and the first one was held in 1897. Number two, the English-Uganda proposition. In other words, the English government offered to give the Zionists, the Jews, a homeland in Uganda. And they kind of toyed with that idea, and they kind of accepted it with the idea that they actually wanted Palestine. But if you take a little, you know, take what they've offered you, make them feel like you're trying to, agree with them and try to cooperate with them. And number three, the future world war. And we're talking 1903, okay? And number four, he talked about the peace conference, where, with the help of England, a free Jewish Palestine will be created. And so the whole objective of World War I was to get Palestine. And they planned the war. They designed the war. They promoted the war. They ignited the war with a false flag. And they got the help of Churchill to do that. And the false flag was the Lusitania, and where there was an explosion. And Churchill, in fact, called the Americans that were traveling on that ship live bait. And you can compare those to the live bait that were in the Twin Towers. You know, whenever you kill a bunch of Americans, it's going to outrage America, and they're going to go along with the government in whatever, you know, war objectives the government might have. And so, yes, live bait is what they called them. Now, you know, if we could get back momentarily to what you asked me before about whether or not Hitler was a Rothschild. Well, one of the first things he did, particularly even before the war, is that he threw the Rothschild bankers out of the country, absolutely out of the country. He was against the Young Plan. He was against the Dawson Plan. And those were plans in 1924, you know, during the 1920s, even before he became had a position in the government. He said, you know, we cannot get indebted to these funds, these international bankers, because the Young Plan was that they wanted to loan the government a bunch of money, and then that money was supposed to be spent with certain contractors in this country. That's not a good thing. You know, you go in, you blow up a country, then you tell the government, well, they have to use certain contractors to rebuild the country, and here we're going to loan you some money at high interest. And so it's just a way of enslaving people economically. And one of the first things that he did when they marched into France was that he confiscated Rothschild property. Now, if he were a Rothschild, if he were close to the Rothschilds in any way, shape, or form, he wouldn't have confiscated their property.
Right.
Correct?
So how did that fairy tale get started, do you think? Because I've heard that from many sources.
Well, that's one of those things where they're trying to take the blame off of the Allies. See, if you put all the blame on Hitler, what a bad guy he was, and look at, he had these camps and people died, then you take all of the focus off of Eisenhower's 200 death camps. Those were really death camps. You take the focus off the fact that the Allies, the real Holocaust of World War II was that the Allies went in and bombed the heck out of Germany, killed millions of people. You had millions of people who were living outside of Germany, who all of a sudden had to go back to Germany because there were property territory that was taken away from Germany after World War I. So you had a lot of people who were on their way back to Germany who were raped and slaughtered. I mean, we're talking millions of people here. And of course you want to make the real bad guy of the entire World War Hitler. You're not going to talk about the 10 million that died during the Ukrainian famine. You're not going to talk about the gulags of Stalin. You're not going to talk about and you can go back to the First World War. I mean, you're not going to talk about the blockades of the First World War, during which so many people starved to death in Germany. You know, it is all designed to create this one big enemy that you can also compare other enemies with Hitler. And that's one of the things that they did when during the 1960s. Remember, I talked about what was going on in the 1960s. They had all these movies talking about the Holocaust. Well, that is also at the same time period where you had the Israelis attacking the USS Liberty on June 8th, 1967. Well, if you could take the Arabs and make a comparison between Hitler and the Arabs, then you could use that same mentality to then go after the Arabs. Just compare them to Hitler, and you'll get the support of the American government and the American people, because everybody knows how bad Hitler was, right?
Exactly, and that's so important what you're saying, and that's one of the things I concentrate on my show all the time, is trying to get people to overstand the situation and see the master template. It's exactly what you said. Instead of Hitler and his SS, we now have Al-Qaeda, a completely CIA-crafted fairy tale, and we're doing the same thing now in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya. I'm sure we're getting ready to go to Iran next. It's the same crap. They do it the same way. And it's because our Zionist-occupied government is taking orders from these people without a conscience. I don't even know how else to describe them. I encourage people. SherryShriner.com actually has an excellent section called Talmud underscore tidbits, and just reading some of the things that these people follow. For example, Sanhedrin 55b, a Jew may marry a three-year-old. Sanhedrin 54b, a Jew may have sex with a child as long as the child is less than 9 years old. Ketubath 11b, when a grown-up man has intercourse with a little girl, it is nothing. And of course, they basically, you know, say over and over again how it's okay, you know, a Jew is expected to treat the fellow Jews as, let's say. But they're allowed to do what they want with the Gentiles because they are considered subhuman animals, in
right.
fact.
Right.
Yes.
Well, you know, it's what is very concerning to me is the fact that all of this has been formalized, institutionalized by the U.S. government. Now, I mentioned before that the number 6 million came up before World War I, and they talked about the 6 million. And that is actually part of their dogma, the Judaic dogma. And so what happened is that back in also happened in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and then formalized under Carter, was decided that they would have a museum, and it was called the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. Very formal. Not the Jewish Holocaust Memorial Museum, but the United States Memorial, Holocaust Memorial Museum. Now, the United States government awarded land in Washington by the Washington Memorial for this museum. It was a group of Jews who got together and formed a commission, and they created a commission report. It was called President's Commission on the Holocaust. The chairman was Elie Wiesel. And as I said, the entire group was composed of a bunch of Jewish people. And they had an educational foundation where they would teach people how to teach the Holocaust. This is a taxpayer-funded museum. Half of the money comes from private donations. The other half comes from the American taxpayer. Now, we've talked about the government being Talmudic. Okay, so we no longer have a manger scene at the White House. We now have the menorah. You mentioned that the president was celebrating Passover. And this has always been, you know, if you look in the last 15 or 20 years, you will find that, in fact, Bush had a kosher kitchen, and I'm sure that Obama also has one. His mother was also Jewish. She's dead now. So you have classes on the Holocaust being taught in your public schools. Okay, now what if our public school teachers, who are paid by the taxpayers, what if they decided that they were going to teach us some Christian dogma? For instance, what do they call that when everybody's going to raise up? What do they call that? I mean, I don't believe that, but but everybody's going to be lifted up. And I can't think of the word.
The rapture.
The rapture. Okay. Yep. What if they had classes on the rapture and they talked about how it would happen and who would go and who would stay and why the people would be allowed to stay? It's the same darn thing as teaching the Holocaust. It is religious dogma.
Exactly. Okay, folks. I know you're listening. I'm shocked we haven't gotten any calls.
Flawless science, please. You.
And we're back with the last segment of What's Ailing America, where our answer today has been the Holocaust hoax with my special guest, Deanna Spingola. We're going to have you back on, Deanna. Actually, I hear the phone ringing off the hook. I went to check my messages, and as has been happening for a number of weeks now, callers are trying to call in. Both numbers are being blocked. So what a surprise not. Okay. E.T. from New Mexico, I was able to pick up his call. He wanted me to ask you about circumcision. Is that he had learned that that's marking of property. Do you have any information on that?
Yes, I actually had somebody on my program not too long ago that talked about circumcision, and circumcision was basically started in about 1865, and it was started supposedly to prevent young children from masturbating, which is a really stupid reason to start something, and when you figure that it is a money-producing technique that it makes money for certain people who do that. I mean, the people who produce the, I guess they use an implement when they're doing this procedure. And it, you know, you have to admit that it does mark a person, and it alters a young boy, an infant. And it's a pretty bad thing.
Well,
pretty
it also
terrible
causes,
thing.
It also causes trauma at the cellular level.
Absolutely.
A man by the name of Rich Winkle on my show a couple of times. He's done a lot of research on this, and in fact, he's made a lot of correlation with domestic violence, with men actually ending up having problems with women because their mothers allowed them to be traumatized in this fashion. So when you realize what these people without conscience, because that's what I call them, that nothing they do has the benefit of humanity in mind. And I had heard somewhere that the high-level rabbis don't even get circumcised themselves. I had mentioned that on my last show with Rich. He said that didn't come from here, but from him, but I know I heard that someplace. So everything they're doing is designed to cause turmoil, just like they say in their last sentence of the 10th protocol, dissension, hatred, torture, you know, and on and on and on. And they're doing a very good job of that. Okay, it's amazing how fast we're running out of time, and I definitely want to have you back on because this is such a huge subject, and I've learned so much myself. There's three quick things I wanted to cover if we have time. First of all, isn't it funny how we have this debate going on? Is Obama a Muslim? Is he an American citizen? As you just said, mommy was a Jew. Well, if mommy was a Jew, that makes Obama a Jew, okay? So isn't it funny how that whole thing got sidebarred?
Right. Well, you know, people can get angry at him for being a Muslim. They're going to get angry at people in the Middle East. And it's just all a hoax. I mean, we got to look at what he's doing. He's following their program. When he was campaigning, he appeared before AIPAC and pledged his loyalty to Israel. I mean, he might as well wear a yarmulke every day, and because he certainly is implementing their program. And when we're talking about a Talmudic nation, which we are a Talmudic nation, you have to understand the size of all, first the size of the Talmud, which is several volumes. It covers every single aspect of a person's life, what to wear, what to eat, how to dress, everything. Absolutely everything. And isn't that what the federal government is doing to the entire nation, particularly with Obamacare, with the Homeland Security, everything, They want total control, rabbinic control over every human being in America. And getting back to the Holocaust Museum situation, I mean, they have a day set aside every day during which people are supposed to have special educational programs, and the states are to participate, cities are supposed to participate. And then you had on April 1st of 1984, Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, a Jew, signed a memorandum to the military services urging the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staffs and other military commanders to participate in the annual program for the first time. So you have all of these people, these formal official people participating in a program to celebrate something that did not even happen. And what the commission wanted to do is to join with the U.S. president and urged the Senate to ratify the Genocide Convention. The commission wanted to punish the criminals of their choice involved in the genocidal activities of World War II. And so then you have the U.S. government now is in charge, basically, of finding people that they allege participated in this Holocaust in World War II and prosecute them. Then you have the prosecution of Nazi war criminals in America. The commission also wants the government to grant high priority to the investigation of all of these so-called criminals. And they also wanted, for number three, Jewish cemeteries abroad. The commission recommends that in recognition of the sanctity of the physical remains of the Jewish communities of Eastern Europe and the right of the dead to a final resting place. In other words, you cannot go to these camps like Auschwitz and dig up anybody or, you know, supposedly if nobody was there, to dig up anybody to present scientific evidence. Because of this law, they're saying, no, we can't do that. We have to have these alleged burial sites. We need to sanctify them as sacred ground. In other words, that does away, will not allow any investigation of any alleged burial site. Well, and this is all official government policy.
Right, exactly. Well, as I read in that last sentence of the 10th Protocol, inoculations of diseases, I mean, talk about genocide. Look at everything that's happening with vaccinations, especially in this country and the Centers for Disease Creation. Talk about the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, it's total opposite day as we expect. But we're almost out of time. Two quick things, more things I wanted to mention. We hear all the time about the Sharia law of the Muslims. What we don't hear about are the Noahide laws of the Talmudists, who talk about beheading and all kinds of things. And I don't know if it's accurate, but I was sent an email a few years ago that our Congress had basically adopted the Noahide laws. Do you know anything about that?
On March 5th, 1991, in the House of Representatives, and March 7th, 1991, in the U.S. Senate, without any knowledge of or input by the people of the United States, U.S. senators and congressmen passed a law that is so outrageous and, frankly, unconstitutional. It is the Noahide Law, which makes it the government can now kill Christians, because part of the Noahide Law, there are seven of them. And one of them is prohibition of blasphemy, which includes the bearing of false witness, the abandonment of idolatry, the prohibition of incest, the prohibition of murder, also of theft, the law against eating flesh. But the thing that is really, really significant here is against idolatry. Now, you read in the Talmud, what people think, what the Jews think of Christ. In other words, they do not think he is worthy of worshiping, and anybody who is worshiping him is guilty of idolatry. This came from the Talmud. It did not come from the Torah. It did not come from the Old Testament. In other words, any Christian who is worshiping Christ, who they regard as somebody that is boiling away in hell in his own excrement. That is what they think of Christ. So they could, because of this law, they have not enforced it yet, but because of this law, they can enforce it at will, and you certainly have them enforcing everything else that's pro-Judaic, all the laws that they've been passing lately, Those are all Talmudic. We are living in a Talmudic society.
Exactly. A Zionist-occupied government. Okay, and we're almost out of time, but one other quick thing I wanted to mention. I've had different guests on my show. Some people say the Zionists are in control. Some people say the Vatican is in control. Some people say the British monarchy is in control. The way I look at it is the Zionists control the Vatican and the British monarchy. But do you have any final words on that subject?
I don't think that the Vatican controls Hollywood. I do not think that the Vatican controls the media. I do not think that the Vatican has an AIPAC-style organization to get the Congress to do everything that they want done. I mean, my goodness, even the Prime Minister of Israel says, hey, we own America. They will do exactly what we tell them to do. I don't see that coming from the Vatican. And when you're talking about Anglo, when you're talking about the British monarchy, well, you have to understand that the Jews have controlled the British monarchy for a very, very, very long time from the City of London.
Exactly. Very well put. Sorry, I got a little activity happening here with my guest dog that I'm babysitting and one of my cats. Never a dull moment. Whoops. Here at the farm. Well, I just want to say, Deanna, that you are so well scholared in these areas, and I'm so grateful to you for sharing your information with my listeners, who unfortunately, once again, were not able to get through on the phone lines. I want to have you on again, and next time I have you on, I'm going to announce it a couple weeks beforehand so people can answer or ask their questions by email so I can ask you, because they're chomping at the bits calling on my personal phone. Thank you so much. People, listen to her show, Spingola Speaks, on republicbroadcasting.org, Monday through Friday, 11 to 1 Central. Thank you so much, Deanna. You are a wealth of information, and I'm so glad to have...
At OrionTalkRadio.com, you could say that we're all talk.
Our guest is Bev Harris of BlackBoxVoting.org.
Well, the bottom line is, whoever can...